Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to part two of the French Connections, a series of educational audio files that we've been putting together for quite some time now. Today's guest is a returnee from last week. I asked him to return with a more specific subject line in our conversations, and it's going to be principally today about what's going on in the relationship between South Africa and Israel and how that has been built over the last century and the history behind it and the consequences of it and who actually was in charge of fomenting some of these terrible events that happened in South Africa and why they did it. His name is James Dickey. He's a lecturer, and he is the French Connections professor on criminal Zionism. That's what he is. That's what you are for us.
Here's the salary corresponding to that chair.
No salary. However, there is a lot of gratitude from Eric and I and my listeners. I'm sure of that. And so we're going to go right into it. James Dickey, welcome again to the French Connection.
Hello. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, James, I want to start right out with a question about South Africa. It was discovered some 200 years ago was mm-hmm. a treasure chest of quality minerals and incredible wildlife, and in fact it was quite sparsely populated 200 years ago. There were not large numbers of tribal Africans living there, and it was like the perfect place for a country to be formed that was not of the African continent. And we had a lot of Dutch and French arrive there. You want to pick up where that history starts?
Yes. This is a country that I know quite well because I've been traveling back and forth to South Africa the last 30 years, and I used to teach a course at UCT once a year, which gave me an opportunity to refresh myself and keep up with current affairs there. Now, South Africa is, as you say correctly, it is a geological freak with an extraordinary number of minerals in its soil, not just gold and diamonds, but other strategic minerals like bauxite, you know, that are essential in the fabrication of steel.
Yes, that's
the result is, whoever controls South Africa controls a certain part of world industry and international trade. Therefore, it was of interest to the Zionist Jews to seize control of that country. Not only that, but you have to take into account the strategic position of Cape Town itself, of Cape Province.
Yeah.
When you think of the Portuguese caravels rounding the Cape there, first of all under Bartolomé Dias, and then later Vasco da Gama, who discovered the sea route to the Indies with the help mm-hmm. of an Arab navigator. Actually, yep. his co-pilot deserted on reaching Mozambique because he realized these people were not Muslims, and therefore they were going to snatch away the monopoly of maritime trade from the Muslims. Mm-hmm. However, this way they were able to establish a series of forts all the way up the east coast of Africa, like Dar es Salaam, then over to India, and finally reaching China with Macau. So that one can say for 100 years, Portugal was the richest country in the world,
mm-hmm.
Ruled over by a king known as Manuel the Fortunate. Because of all the gold pouring into his coffers, the spices unloading on the quays at Lisbon, because in those days all meat had to be treated with spice. You see, with the decline of Portugal as a global maritime power, there took place the rise of Holland. Now, Holland was where the Sephardic Jews had taken refuge when they were expelled by Ferdinand and Isabel from Spain in 1492. And they had set up in Amsterdam in a big way, and right down to today, Amsterdam is a principal center of Jewish Zionist power. Now, with the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, which I think was 1695 or thereabouts,
mm-hmm.
The French Protestants, the Huguenots, emigrated. Well, of course, some emigrated here to Britain and set up the textile industry, which they monopolized for about 200 years. And others emigrated to South Africa, which, as you said, was virgin territory. Well, because the Dutch had replaced the Holland had replaced Portugal as mistress of the seas, and Cape Town was in fact a Dutch foundation, and is still the original Dutch port there to protect their trade routes to the east. Then lots of Dutchmen had gone there in the 17th century. It was virtually an empty country. As you said, I mean, some black tribes had infiltrated down from the north. The two clashed, and eventually with their superior technology, the Afrikaners, who have a mixed of mixed Dutch, French, Huguenot stock, they won. But later, they themselves were defeated by the British, and that opens the scenario that we confront today.
Yes, now that's important because there was a struggle when they didn't know at the earliest stages how rich mineral-wise that country was. They had some inklings about it, but it wasn't until the British became very aware that this country had vast reserves of things like diamonds and more importantly at that time gold, the British Empire decided along with the Jewish interests that it was time for them to make a move on that area. Now, what is it that they did specifically to these Afrikaners?
Well, it was the discovery of gold under the Afrikaner farms that precipitated the Boer War. And many people think that the Arabs, including the Arabs themselves, the Arabs lost Palestine as a consequence of the First World War and the Balfour Declaration, the bribe to bring in to get the Jews to use their economic leverage in America to bring the United States into the war on the side of Britain. But in fact, I sustain a different thesis. I would say that the Arabs lost Palestine back in 1900, at the time of the Boer War. And can I explain this to you? Can I outline my theory in this regard?
Please do. Please do.
Yeah. Well, look, we have to go back beyond, really, the Jimmison Raid, which started it all, and the Boer War, because what we confront today is a coalition of interests. International Zionism, the forces of globalization, the power of the oil companies deriving from the dependence of the West on fossil fuel. But it is, in fact, much more complex. It goes a long way back, right back to Oxford and Ruskin. You know Ruskin College in Oxford?
Yes, I do, yeah.
So, the idea of Anglo-Saxon superiority, and therefore their inherent right to control the destinies of the globe, is implicit in the thinking of the disciples that Ruskin gathered around him. And that thinking, which was implicit with Ruskin, became explicit with Rhodes and Stead. Now, Stead, you know him, William Stead, another Ruskin disciple, the man who went down in the Titanic. Hmm? He wrote a very interesting book on ghosts, on psychic phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Table Mountain Society, and here we have a coincidence, you know, between Round Table, going back to 19th century Romanticism, Tennyson, and the Arthurian tradition, and also Table Mountain, which is in fact like a table. In fact, it's even got its own tablecloth. Many a day I've stood in the city and looked up, and with the mist hanging draped over the sides of the mountain and covering its flat surface, it looks exactly like a tablecloth. Now, the Table Mountain Society, its members included Lords Grey and Rothschild. It was founded in 1891, and the executive committee comprised Cecil Rhodes, who was the president, Stead, the journalist of whom we've just spoken, Lord Esher and Lord Milner, Balfour, Sir Harry Johnson, Lord Rothschild and Lord Grey, representing the Foreign Office and therefore the Germanophobic interest, they comprised the Circle of Initiates. Now, this was the inner component, one can say the esoteric aspect of the Table Mountain Society, but there was a public or exoteric aspect, and that was formed later by Milner with the title of Round Table. So here we have this confusing coincidence and table, but in fact the two are distinct organizations.
Okay.
There is in fact an entire underworld of conspirators involved here, the Times clique, the Chatham House clique, and the Pilgrims. Now, note here, the Pilgrims with a capital P as name of a society. Note the Mayflower reference. That is to say, originally, these people, to begin with, were all Puritan WASPs, but gradually they were replaced by Jews. And the whole group was known as the Milner Kindergarten. But the key formations are two, one in America and one in this country. The one in this country is known as the Group, based in Oxford, and the one in America is known as the Order, based on Yale.
Okay.
Now, the following dates are significant. Between the years 1891 and 1902, there took place the Boer War.
That's right.
As I said, most people, including most Arabs, believe that they lost Palestine as a consequence of the First World War. But it is arguable that the determinant of modern Middle Eastern history was not, as commonly believed, the First World War, but the Boer War. It was the discovery, as I said earlier, of gold under the Afrikaner farms that prompted the outbreak of that conflict, because the Zionists needed the gold to finance the colonization of Palestine, which had been already determined at the first Zionist Congress in Basel in 1897, if not before.
Yeah.
Now, the Round Table was the nucleus of a number of groups, all called Round Tables, and all, one and all, financed by the Rhodes Foundation. Rhodes, you know, was fabulously rich. By 1915, that is to say, by the time of the First World War, they had spread throughout seven countries. I'll list them. Britain, South Africa, Canada, United States, Australia, New Zealand, and India.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, the American cell comprised Walter Lippmann, Thomas Lamont, and Jerome Green. These names are not very well known today. They published a newsletter called The Round Table. Now, as well as these, groups representing financial and industrial magnates and politicians in Britain grouped themselves around about the Round Table, and in America around about J.P. Morgan. In Princeton also, there was the British lot known as the Group, and the Americans known as the Order, based on Yale. The Institute of Advanced Studies in Princeton is closely connected with this. It comprised Einstein, Oppenheimer, the head of the Manhattan Project that gave us the atom bomb, and George Kennan. Apart from J.P. Morgan, the Order was financed by my fellow Scot, Andrew Carnegie, reckoned to be at that time the richest man in the world. You know the great steel magnate?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, we all know about the think tank that is financed by his, that runs on his money today.
Carnegie Mellon Institute, yeah.
Yeah, uh-huh. And the Foundation for Universal Peace, I think it's called, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Is that an oxymoron?
It was also financed by Rockefeller. We shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that all of these people attended the synagogue. I mean, the Rockefellers, they're Huguenots. Rockefeller was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford, you know, like Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
Now, other contributors, because running a round table was a very costly affair, were Lazard Frere and Morgan Grenfell. Correct me if I be wrong, but I think both of these are Jewish. Lazard failed, certainly.
Yeah.
Now, these people installed individuals of their own choosing in top political circles in Britain. The Oxford Group was an elitist, semi-clandestine organization. Their objective was to federate all Anglophone peoples as dreamt of by Rhodes and W.T. Stead. Simultaneously, from luxurious offices in Wall Street, they've extended an equally complex web. But I want to go back now to the date of the first British incursion into the Transvaal, where the gold was.
Yeah.
And that is 1895.
Mm-hmm.
Called again after my famous Scot, the famous fellow Scot, Jimison. Now, here, my house in Greenock is known as Jimison Place. So, presumably, it was called after him. But Jimison was, in fact, a criminal. He was caught. The whole idea of the Jimison raid was to create a casus belli for war between England, or rather the British Empire, and the two Boer republics to the north. Because when the British landed in Cape Province in 1810, gradually they drove the Boers out, or the Boers chose to leave. That took place the Great Trek, and then they founded the two republics, the Orange Free State and the Transvaal. Now,
that's where Rhodesia was ultimately built, and now is is what is it? Zimbabwe, not Zimbabwe. What's the country north of South Africa now? That's where Rhodes. Where
well, that, Zimbabwe is
Zimbabwe.
Rhodesia. Yeah. It's the same. It was originally called after Rhodesia. You know, his object was to convert the whole of the continent of Africa into a province of Great Britain with the Cape to Cairo Railway, which never quite came off. However, the situation was getting out of hand. The British sent Milner, another Rhodes scholar and follower of Ruskin. You see how all this ties together. It's an intellectual group around about Ruskin in Oxford in Victorian times, all convinced that it is the destiny of the Anglo-Saxons to rule the world. Now, Milner was sent as plenipotentiary to negotiate with President Kruger. And present at the negotiations was the engineer in charge of the Rothschild mines, John Hammond. He had formed part of the Uitlanders Committee. These are the people who staged the Jameson raid.
Mm-hmm.
They, along with Lionel Phillips, who was likewise head of mines, but this time mines belonging to the House of Eckstein. Also, Colonel Frank Rhodes, Cecil Rhodes' brother, Abe Bailey, Solly Joel, Barney Barnato, and representatives of the Eckstein interest, all of them Jewish, with the sole exception of Rhodes' brother.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Milner, to whom there is a monument in Cape Town Cathedral, and you know that's Archbishop Desmond Tutu's church, and this gentleman, who is a publicity hound, he loves touring around British universities, giving talks to enthusiastic students who think he's just the cat's pajamas. The cat's pajamas, they think he's the kipper's knickers, standing for freedom in South Africa. So if ever I meet him in debate, I'm going to ask him, why are there so many memorials to Zionists in your cathedral? One of them being Milner, and another, of course, Rhodes himself.
Yeah.
At any rate, Milner, you see, was lacking in tact, and the negotiations with President Kruger failed. In my view, they were probably intended to fail so that Britain could declare war on the two Boer republics. The British in South Africa actually forged the signatures on the Uitlanders' petition of complaint to Queen Victoria, and war broke out. The British government dispatched Lord Roberts, known otherwise as the Butcher of South Africa, who set up the concentration camps, burned the farms, destroyed the crops, killed off the livestock, and finally committed genocide by introducing diseases into the camps on purpose to wipe out the women and the children, and thereby, you see, to strike at the biological root of the Afrikaner nation. Now, the men who were busy fighting in the veld could be killed off. The idea is exactly the same as Zionism in Palestine or Manifest Destiny in the United States, to create an empty landscape that could be colonized, in this case, by people of Anglo-Saxon descent or Anglo-Saxon stock, forced to emigrate from their own country by poverty. Like, for instance, you take my country, Little Scotland. Our population is only 5 million. How many Scots do you think there really are in the whole world? Give me an idea.
There's probably double that number, no?
Double?
More than 10 million?
Four times it. The total number of Scots in the world is 25 million, of
whom
only
5
million, 5 million live in Scotland. The rest emigrated.
Well, I know the Irish are 1 in 4 people in America are Irish, and in Ireland has nowhere near that number.
Ireland is only 4 million. The population used to be 8 million. 4 million either died off in the potato famine of the 1840s or emigrated to the United States.
That's right. Hmm? Today, almost everybody has some Irish blood in them in the United States.
Well, then, everybody must in some way be related to a New York policeman, then, mustn't they?
That's right.
Well, you see, the empty landscape policy was pursued by the Zionists in Palestine so it could be colonized by the poorer class of Jew from Poland and Russia in the interests of the rich. But that's another story for another night.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of British soldiers got killed by the Boer sharpshooters because, as you know, they are amongst the finest guerrilla fighters in the world. But, as you can see, looking at any war memorial here in Britain, the name of not a single Rothschild figures amongst the fallen.
Have you any
questions to ask on that score? Shall we move on to the Oppenheimer scenario?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay.
And for the people that don't know who Cecil B. Rhodes is, the founder of Rhodesia, the mining magnate, the round table member, the close to the British crown. He was a big proponent of Anglo-Saxon supremacy. And there are listeners, sadly, James, that are not completely aware of some of these histories. So I'm urging all of you maybe to find out who Cecil B. Rhodes was and what his connection to this southern region of Africa is and what he really did. Because there are some there's some caveats that needed to be added to that so that people could maybe follow along with who this gentleman was. But go ahead.
If you want to follow and understand the history of the 20th century, it's essential to understand to have read the Seven Testaments of Cecil Rhodes. They were written in 1877 to 99, and they are kept in Rhodes House in Oxford. Now, the first five outline his scheme for a utopia ruled by a secret elite, using the British Empire as their political axis. Now, you see here the alliance between political Zionism and Jewish finance on one hand, and the other, the manpower and military might of Great Britain.
Now, and then as a juxtaposition, the American military now.
Oh, yeah. Well, in these five testaments, it set out what is to be done with each country in the world, what's to be done with China, what is to be done with Russia, and so on, country by country. Now, the sixth, which is perhaps the key one, proposes that this elite be recruited from amongst those graduates, the Rhodes Scholarship, set up with the help of his fabulous wealth. Now, Bill Clinton was one of those favored graduates, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yep.
And the seventh deals with his the arrangements for his funeral in Rhodesia. The tomb was visited by the Queen, by the way. Rhodes had always been, he had been born weak, in fact. He was prone to TB, and he lived always with the thought of early death. In fact, he didn't even make 50, he died at 49. And the influence of this corpulent, red-haired individual with a really high-pitched voice radiated out from Oxford over all five continents. The principal sources which financed and promoted these schemes were the Carnegie Trust, the J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Whitney, a member of the order, Lazard Frere, and Morgan Grenfell.
Okay.
Right. Now, I mentioned earlier Oppenheimer. We have to study how Oppenheimer came to control of assume control of South Africa and its diamonds. Rhodes' closest associate was a man called Charles Rudd. But apart from the Rothschilds, and Rhodes was an employee of the Rothschilds, Rhodes worked very closely with Alfred Bate and Barney Israel, aka Barney Barnato. Together, these people set up a network of companies and shareholders which came to control 90% of the world's diamonds production, controlling both production and sale, and this was known as the London Syndicate. The First World War interrupted their plans, and there was a movement headed by Ernest Oppenheimer to detach the diamond industry from the London Syndicate. Now, Rhodes, who was a follower of Ruskin, wrote to Stead, again a Ruskin pupil, "I seek a union with America and universal peace." Now, do these terms sound familiar? Universal peace? Is not the Carnegie Foundation called the Carnegie Foundation for Universal Peace?
Exactly right, yeah.
Which I'm continuing to quote Rhodes, which, says Rhodes, "I think could be achieved inside 100 years. Now, this was uttered 100 years ago. So either it's been achieved by now, or it's on the point of being achieved. And he goes on, and this is most interesting, "I'm thinking also to found a secret society on the model of the Company of Loyola, that is to say the Jesuits, and maintained by the finance of those determined to make their mark on history." Isn't that interesting? Because the SS is also modeled on the Jesuit order.
Now, what role did the Jesuits themselves play? Any, if just by just the model?
An organizational model, but
not an actual hands-on model, right? Because I mean, we're not talking participation of the Jesuits, are we?
Oh no, not at all. But remember, the Jesuits are again a semi-clandestine organization. For instance, the general of the Jesuit order, and it's because it's organized like an army, known as the Black Pope, is the only man in the whole world who has the right to enter the Pope's private apartments in the Vatican unannounced. Now, they must have tremendous power for this. Now, the Jesuits are, of course, behind the modernist movement, which came to power with the Second Vatican Council back in 1965, which turned the traditional teaching of the Catholic Church upside down, including putting the blame on the Jews for the death of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Milner, I mean, we were speaking last week about the Balfour Declaration, weren't we?
And, that's right, we were. Yeah.
First of all, the attempt that the British made to use the Armenians to bring the America into the war on the side of the British.
That's right.
And then when they realized that the Armenians had neither the number nor the economic power to effect this, with Britain, the defeat staring Britain in the face in 1916 and 17, then they had to use the Jews. Now, interestingly, Milner was the co-author of the Balfour Declaration. He, Balfour, and Rothschild were all members of the same Masonic Lodge and members of the Round Table. Now, Cardinal House, again whom we mentioned last week, was rewarded for his part in bringing America into the war by being given a seat on the War Cabinet here in London, although he didn't have British nationality and wasn't a Cardinal any more than I am. I mean, he was Kentucky Cardinal, like Colonel Saunders and his fried chicken.
Yeah.
Now, Lloyd George was the loyal advisor to the British Zionists, and he was backed by Chaim Weizmann, the Conkers man. Now, maybe being an American, you don't know what Conkers are. Do you know what Conkers are?
No, please.
Oh, if you were growing up in a British school, you would know what Conkers. You see, in the autumn, when the chestnut trees shed their nuts, boys go around and pick them up and heat them in front of the fire, and then you take a red-hot steel knitting needle, and you put a hole in it,
and then you tie. We did that when we were kids, and threw them over the wires all over the neighborhood.
Well, what we do is we hold them between two fingers of the left hand, with the right hand holding the end of the string, and you try to knock your opponent's conker into submission. Is that how you do it in America?
No, we made little bola whips out of them and threw them up on the wires.
Oh, well, that's completely different. Because, well, I'm coming really to the, I'm not being as frivolous as I may at first sight appear.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when one conker has smashed another, your opponent's conker, it's known as bully one, and so on. And schoolboys exchange these conkers. I mean, mine is a bully 10, yours is a bully 15, how much will you give me for yours, that sort of thing. However, Chaim Weizmann, professor of chemistry at Manchester University, you can imagine how I felt going into a Zionist environment like Manchester University after I came back from Franco, Spain in the 1960s. At any rate, he held the chair of chemistry there, and he discovered that chestnuts contained a vital ingredient for, I think, the composition of cordite. Which was necessary in the British shells in the First World War. I mean, this was long before the days of depleted uranium. We're talking when all the main propellant in artillery was cordite. Now, the boys, instead of going around and picking up the conkers in order to be buoy 10 or buoy 15, they picked them up patriotically and sent them off in their thousands to the war factories. Where this chemical ingredient was extracted. Now, Chaim Weizmann had done such a service to the British at the height of the First World War that he was appointed war minister.
Mm.
And Rabbi Wise at this moment, because remember the Balfour Declaration had just been issued, Rabbi Wise in the United States, he wrote to Louis Brandeis, President of the Supreme Court, that he had sent our memorandum, that shows who had really written it, doesn't it? That he had sent our memorandum to Colonel House. Colonel House was the eminence grise behind Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah.
Weizmann told William Yale of the State Department that if the British didn't keep their word, that is to say the Balfour Declaration, they would bring down the British Empire the way they had brought down the Russian. But he needn't have worried. The Oxford Group dating from the time of Ruskin and Rhodes and their transatlantic counterparts in Wall Street, i.e. the Pilgrims, still masquerading, you see, as a WASP foundation,
right,
were all working toward the same goal.
And weren't there about 120 very powerful Jewish businessmen that were involved in the Balfour signing, including Untermeyer, including Benjamin Friedman, including Morgenthau, and, I mean, there was a list.
You've got it straight on. The entire financial aristocracy of Wall Street was involved in that document.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're spot on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these elementary organizations that we've been speaking of, Roundtable, the Pilgrims, so on, of Boer War vintage, are now represented by organizations like the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Brookings Institute, the Rand Corporation, the Aspen Institute, the former U.S.-URSS Trade Council, USTECO, the American Company for East-West Accord, ACEWA.
How about the Stanford Institute out in the West Coast?
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that one. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
On the West Coast.
Yep.
Because most of what we're dealing with is the East Coast elite, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Originally WASPs, but then gradually replaced with Jews. The Club of Rome, the Americans for Democratic Action, the Atlantic Council, the English-speaking Union, the League for Industrial Democracy, and now the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers. Now, the proper name of Chatham House is the Institute of International Studies, or Institute of International Affairs, set up by Royal Charter, that is to say King George V, in 1923. Now, it and the CFR, the Council for Foreign Relations in Washington, are really one and the same outfit. It's just they have different names so as to preserve the illusion of independence. They are both funded from the same sources.
Okay.
That's to say, Wall Street.
Yeah.
Now, Colonel Mandelhaus, who was present at Versailles, was invited to a working breakfast in May 1919. And besides himself, as a member of the Round Table, there were certain other participants. They included, and I think some of these names will resonate with you, what about John Foster Dulles, for instance?
Yeah.
The future Secretary of State.
Mm-hmm.
Even more so, perhaps, his brother, Alan Dulles, head of espionage.
Yep. Mm,
during World War II.
OSI, right.
Yeah, and future director of the CIA.
That's right.
James Shotwell, Bill Lansing, Christian Herter, later Secretary of State, Jerome Green, the accountant to the Rockefeller Institute, Professor Carey Coolidge, Whitney, Shepperdon, General Tasker Bliss. A lot of these are very well-known New England names, aren't they?
Yes.
Showing that the old WASP financial aristocracy was now being subsumed under a Jewish Zionist takeover.
Who were the movers and shakers in the financial side of that takeover? Was it still the elites from Europe that were financing the takeover of this WASP group?
No, I would say so. By now it was Oppenheimer and Rothschild.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right. Now, these people installed individuals of their own choosing in top political circles in Britain and America. Their original objective was a federation of all Anglophone peoples, as dreamt of by Rhodes and Staed. Their extended an equally complex web from Wall Street as from Oxford and the city in London. Now, I think the only thing we have to deal with, really, is the genesis of the pair that dialogue across the Atlantic, the CFR and Chatham House here in Britain. The Royal Institute of International Affairs, let's say Chatham House, set up in Billy Pitt's old house, and the Council for Foreign Relations, the CFR, were both present at this breakfast. That is to say, although they hadn't yet been founded. They weren't founded till 1923, and this breakfast took place, the working breakfast, in 1919. All the people that would later constitute these twin organizations directing British and American policy were present there in May 1919. So it seems that this working breakfast was one of the most decisive moments in the history of the 20th century, because it coordinated on a permanent and regular basis what until then had been sporadic.
Now, the foundation for this was still Cecil B. Rhodes and his
network. In fact, Chatham House, Billy Pitt's old house, had been the seat of the Round Table. There was continuity. All this forms a continuum.
Okay.
In fact, from time to table, round tables are still held there.
Now, when did this start shifting toward a more Lubavitch Jewish type of bent to it? Because we're still talking about a great number of WASPs involved, but you said yourself that over time they started becoming marginalized in the leadership because much of the control of it was to the Rothschilds and Oppenheimer. So, of course, when they started taking a leadership role in this, the agenda started to shift a bit, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I would say the process was more or less complete by the time that Roosevelt came to power in 1933, wasn't it?
Now, so what was their motivation? The fact that they had already...
Well, Roosevelt was their creation, and so was the New Deal. I mean, most of the New Dealers were Jewish economists.
Well, I know that, but my point being, their motivation at this point to start shifting toward these Zionist interests was the fact that they had already received the signature on that Balfour document, and they had already concocted their idea of resettlement, and it was well underway. But what they needed was a plan to get the people to move from their present location, which was Northern Europe and across parts of Europe, and to immigrate to this place. Now, were they already aware of their ultimate goal of setting up a world government in that region at this time? Because I've read documents and read information that said this plan for them goes back for over 100 years, and in fact, it marries quite well with the protocols of Zion, because if you take a look at those documents, they're 100 years old or more, and yet they're spot on history.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
They must have been using that as their playbook.
I mean, look, didn't Max Nordau, N-O-R-D-A-U, say, I think at the Second Zionist Congress, that let me show you the future as if the rungs on a ladder leading up and up. And then he said the coming world conflict, when with the help of England, a national home for the Jews will be established in Palestine. This was 1898, I think.
That's right.
And
okay.
How could he then predict the outbreak of World War 16 years hence?
And not only
that, I can't even tell you who's going to win the next bloody election here in Britain.
Well, here's the interesting thing. So they allowed the WASPs, these people, to remain pseudo-control, thinking
as figureheads,
and
enjoy their wealth.
That's right.
And the illusion of power.
That's right. And in fact, what was happening is right out from under them, they were being usurped by this new organization that also brought into play the Masonic movement that had spread across the country as a secondary control organ for these smaller, more elitist groups. They were still using their umbrella organizations that had been set up 100 years before this, even. So in other words, Freemasonry went all the way back to 1780, 90 in America, and what they were doing was, it seems, 100 years later, are using these small organizations such as the Round Table and whatnot to control their organization throughout America and all the English-speaking world. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Well, I've got the protocols here in front of me as you speak. And one of the protocols deals, in fact, with Freemasonry and how it will be used. Masonic freedom, control of printing and publishing, the idol of the press. Mm-hmm. And this outlines, in detail, a scheme for world government.
Yeah, and they by this time they were already financing people like Hearst out in the West Coast and his paper, newspaper, and the Gannett Group, and they were already starting the Tribune Group. And in other words, they were already starting to be very powerful in the press back 120, 30 years ago. And they were doing this through their Masonic groups, weren't they?
Yeah. And they, in Britain, the press is dominated by giant press barons, all of them Jewish, like Murdoch and Maxwell. And you know, it transpired after Maxwell's death, or pseudo-death, because some people think he's still alive and is hiding in Latin America. It transpired after his death that, in fact, he had been working all along for Mossad.
There's no surprise there for me.
Now you see, the problem with the Jews is number. They have the finance, the technology, and the know-how to hold down the whole of the Middle East and West Asia. The one thing that they lack is the manpower. And they're getting it now, you know, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The population of Israel is now 6 million, which is more than Scotland. But how could they expand this trickle of immigrants into Palestine, largely idealists, working in kibbutzim and therefore not earning any salary, into a torrent? And the torrent took place during the Second World War. You remember all this after 1945 about the DPs, the displaced persons, the camps set up for them, and how they were transported en masse to Israel.
That's right, yep. And in fact, there was even an earlier exodus that happened in the late 1930s, 35, 6, 7. And in fact, some of these people were actually shipped to America, and America, at the urgings of these controllers, including Rothschild, refused to accept these people because they did not want that group to be populating America. They wanted them sent to the Holy Land.
Yeah, most definitely. And there was that ship. You see, the policy of the Nazis at that time had been to get the Jews out of Germany to forever. So long as they left Germany, that was the only thing that mattered. Whether they went to Palestine or elsewhere, they didn't give a damn. And I think this was very short-sighted. And remember that ship that left Hamburg? When was it? 1938? And went around all the ports, including Cuba, and not a single country would take them in.
Well, they were told not to accept them by...
Well, exactly, And there's a film about it, but the film does not tell the truth. Since when did Hollywood ever tell the truth? I mean, Hollywood is a factory of lies.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, so we get all the way up to the 30s, and what we need here now is a good excuse for a foment to move these masses to the new Palestine, which was promised to this group under Balfour, and they were what basically was promised is the British Empire's might, and ultimately the Americans' might when it turned to it, to bring these people a population. Now the only way they could do that was to start a conflict that would cause these people to want to leave Europe. They were very cosmopolitan for the most part, and I understand from reading documents that many Jews were starting to migrate away from strict Judaism, and they were starting to be married into the populations of the countries they were living in.
Assimilated.
Particularly
in Germany and Austria, even more in Austria than in Germany.
Well, there was a big fear amongst this leadership that wanted to do all these things, that this whole population was going to filter into the regular population, and their whole plan was going to be nixed. So what they did, apparently, was they began this march toward war, and in order to get that, of course, Hitler needed finance credits, and then there we see Max Warburg and we see the Harriman fortune getting employed through Rothschild, but the Bush family getting involved and many others financing to start this process of exodus. Am I wrong?
You are spot on as always. In fact, I mean, it's perfectly clear, even to a political duffer, that the Second World War was a conspiracy. And the proof of this is how it started. It began with the invasion of Poland. Two countries, that is to say Germany and the Soviet Union invade Poland simultaneously, and Britain declares war against one. Well, Britain guaranteed Poland's frontiers, then that means guaranteeing the eastern frontier as well as the western, doesn't it?
It does, yes, yes.
And at this moment, large tracts of Polish territory are in fact inside the Soviet Union. So
now,
in my opinion, the Second World War is still on, but I don't know why we're not fighting it.
Well, now, here's the interesting thing. Now, the whole power structure in Russia at that particular moment in history
was Jewish.
Bought and paid for by the Jews.
Well,
including Stalin had his one foot in the Jewish community, didn't he?
He was married to Rosa Kaganovich.
That's right.
The Minister of Industry.
And see now.
I mean, the sister of the Ministry of India, Industry.
Mm-hmm. Now, he had already purged 35 or 40 million Christians from the steppes of Russia, and in fact, they were actually committing genocides on behalf of Zionist interests already. So he was really far, far, far more brutal and more heinous than Hitler ever ended up becoming. This man was much more of a monster than Adolf Hitler ever was. And in fact, we just turned a blind eye to the things he did from 1917 all the way through 1938 and beyond, even.
Yeah. And not only that, but during the Second World War, the lives of all the Soviet Jews were sacrosanct. Do you know that he moved the Jewish population off the Soviet Union to behind the Urals, where the Germans couldn't get at them?
Mm-hmm. So basically, he just threw the Orthodox Christians to the lions, basically, and ground them up in a war with a Christian Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And took the and plus the Jews that were still in Germany were actually pushed eastward. Were they not out of Germany to eastern camps?
Yes, the concentration camps, which were set up in Poland mostly.
That's right. Now, why did they select Poland? Because they wanted to shove them toward the Russians, or?
I'm not sure really of the reason for that. But I mean, their ostensible reason was resettlement in the east.
Well, that's where the Khazars had come from in the first place, isn't it?
Well, the Khazars, they were in the Caucasus. Now, I'm glad you brought up the Khazars, because this is a very interesting phase of history. You see, the Khazars were a small Caucasian people trapped between two great empires, the Islamic Empire to the south,
mm-hmm.
and the Christian Russian Orthodox Empire to the north.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not just Russian Orthodox, but, you know, Byzantine. Anyway,
right.
The Orthodox Church. So they were trapped between the forces of Orthodoxy and the forces of Islam. And the issue for them was one of independence. So the whole thing is summed up in a historical account, which probably has some basis in reality, but it is, I think, largely fictitious. It's a dramatization of what really took place. The king of the Khazars, he invited representatives of the three monotheistic faiths to come to his court and debate Islam, Christianity, and Judaism.
But he already had the Kagan already had a large Jewish population living there. I mean, he had Jewish.
Well, to know about the Jews, he must already have known about them from somewhere, mustn't he?
That's right. And he had
mm-hmm.
Jewish traders that were trading between the Russian Christians and the Arabs down to the south.
Oh yeah. And between the Caspian and the Volga. Hmm?
Yes.
These were important trade routes.
Yep.
Now, he invited representatives of all three faiths, and then he said that the Jewish rabbis have won the debate. And in fact, this is a dramatization, really, of the need for political survival. If the Khazar state were to survive, and the Khazar people were to survive as an independent entity and not be gobbled up by one of the other two gigantic, powerful empires, this was the only way they could do it. So it's very questionable whether the modern-day inhabitants of Israel can in fact, trace their ancestry to the ancient Hebrews of Palestine.
Well, we've actually talked about this with several scholars, including David Pitcock and also with Muhammad Rafik and many others. We're the listeners that you're speaking to know this history. And interestingly enough, now what we've got is this, we've got this particular roundtable now moving these Germans toward war in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And, of course, after their defeat, when Roosevelt went over to, and Churchill went over to Malta and spoke with this monster, Stalin, they gave him virtually all of the East as a protectorate. They gave it to him. Now, of course, at the time, they sold it to the world as saying the Russians are demanding a buffer zone between their nation and Germany's penchant for war. Now, that was a lie, of course. Basically, what it was just a demarcation line.
It was a piece of horse trading that took place at Yalta, at Tehran, and then later it sealed at Potsdam.
Yeah,
and this created a bipolar world.
With the urgings of the Zionists, so that they could play one off against the other, as having a right left communist capitalist world that they could use as a way to have huge defense budgets on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Now, all this goes back to the Pale. You see, the idea of the Tsar was that he was known as the Little Father, that is to say, the protecting friend of the Russian people, who protected the ordinary Russian mujik against the predatory boyars. Now, by the 19th century, the boyars had their fangs drawn. I mean, they were still big landowners and very rich, of course, and well-educated, but they were no longer petty sultans as they were in the Middle Ages. They had been replaced by those new boyars, the Jews.
Yes,
and he saw it as his duty to protect the Russian people against these new boyars the way he had formerly protected them against the exploitative landowners. And the result is he confined them to the Pale. Now, the Jews inside the Pale, they came up with two theories as to how to get out of there, how to get out of the Pale, and what to do once they got out. Now, these two theories are, in fact, Zionism and Bolshevism. They are both sides of the same coin. In the same family, you would have one son who was a Zionist, say, Moishe, another, Reuben, who was a communist. You can just picture the scene, can't you? At dinner table, the two going hammer and tongs at each other, and the Yiddish mama, that eternal figure, saying, oh, just shut up, just give me peace, just give me peace. But the fact is, both are Jewish, Zionism and communism. And they have always collaborated. In fact, Soviet Russia was the second country in the world to recognize the existence of Israel. The first was the United States. Now, is that not significant?
It is significant.
But there are things that I can't explain in world history. Now, you know that Saudi Arabia is considered by all political authorities to be a medieval theocracy, isn't it?
That's quite
the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Now, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was formed with the annexation of the Hejaz in 1924, which was taken from the Hashemites and absorbed into the Kingdom of the Sultanate of Yezd. And this was essentially a British creation who didn't want their Middle Eastern agency, the Hashemite family, to get too powerful. But which was the first country in the world to extend diplomatic recognition to this newly created theocratic kingdom? Can you guess?
The British, I would imagine.
No! It was the Soviet Union. Now, why should a communist country recognize a theocratic state? That's one of the mysteries of history. I still haven't solved it myself.
Well, we know that the ties between the nation state of Israel, or this false country that they call Israel, and the Saudi government and King Fahd's family, the Saud family, go back all the way to the origins. And in fact, it was
the origins of the Saudi family.
That's right.
Yes, most definitely. Their ancestry has been traced to a family of Jewish merchants from Basra who emigrated to Najd, say the oasis of Najd in Central Arabia in the 18th century.
So they're they may be crypto Jews.
Could be. Like the Khatas and the Dolmesh.
That's right.
And in fact, the family do look Jewish, don't they? However, there was, I think, a Lebanese scholar called Nasser Said. Maybe he's Palestinian or Jordanian. I mean, it doesn't really make much difference because the same families live in Beirut, as live in Damascus, as live in Amman, as live in Jerusalem. It's all Syria, which you Americans properly call, you say so-and-so, your next door neighbor is a Syrian. You don't say he's Lebanese or Jordanian, do you? Just use the term Syrian. Because that goes back to before the First World War, when it was one country. Anyway, Nasser Said, who hails from that part of the world, wrote a book tracing the genealogy of this family back to its Jewish roots in Basra, say in southern Iraq, in the 18th century. So, you know, here, we never hear even one quarter of the truth. And I have never seen it mentioned in any Western medium, press, television, radio, anything, about the fate of Nasser Said. You know what happened to him?
What happened?
PLO put him in a crate and flew him off to Riyadh. They sold him to the Saudis for an untold sum of money. He was kidnapped. And he, 12 years ago, in a debate on the LSE in London, which I think is a Zionist stronghold, actually, but I'd been invited by the Muslim Students' Union to talk, and I mentioned Nasser Said, and something very interesting happened. I said, and he was flown out to Riyadh in a crate, and nobody knows whether he'd be alive or dead. And an anonymous slip of paper was passed up to the platform, which said, Nasser Said is alive. He was seen recently in a jail in Saudi Arabia. It was unsigned, but I read it out.
Well, see, now, here's the interesting thing, what we've got now. We've got a power play happening in present time. Right now, we're trying to depopulate the old Babylonian region of the Euphrates. It's working quite well. We're poisoning the region with depleted uranium. We're killing off the population. The second goal is to neuter the Iranian area, not necessarily to steal their oil, but probably to remove it from production so that the oil that's left behind becomes triple in value, and neuter, of course, the Iranian threat to this new empire being built in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to use the British and the American military might and the American public as their stooges to carry this out. Am I correct in assuming?
It's the old Boer War scenario over again, action repeat of the Boer War. I said thousands of British soldiers lost their lives to the Boer sharpshooters, but on those war memorials here in Britain, you will not find the name of a single Rothschild, the man who sent them to their deaths. And it's the same. Nothing in 100 years, nothing has changed.
So now, you know something, I we're going to wrap this up because we usually spend about an hour and a couple of minutes on these subjects. We've brought ourselves up to the present, albeit kind of quickly. We missed the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s, which would have fit in quite well with the rest of the story. And I hope to have you back to fill in those areas for us, James, you know, because you do tell a powerful historical trail here. However, the fact is right now they are not going to back off from this attack on Iran because it is part of their goal. They have to do this in order to be successful at this new empire they're forming.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, I think probably they're going to move on a Syrian assault before they do on Iran. Possibly.
Syria is the weaker front. You see, the present government of Iran, I would say not the mullahs, but this one under Ahmadinejad, is extremely popular. I mean, he's a very simple man. He reminds one of Saladin or the early caliphs, a man like Imam Khomeini who sits on a mat and eats yogurt. He drove about Tehran when he was mayor of Tehran in a very simple car. So he is universally popular, whereas the Syrian government is universally hated because it committed an act of genocide on its own people back in 1982 in Hama.
Yeah.
So Syria is the weaker of the two fronts.
So Syria might fall with just using the subterfuge, but I think Iran's going to be a far more aggressive type of action.
They're reluctant to take on Iran because they saw the degree of self-sacrifice of which the Iranian people was capable in the Iran-Iraq war, and they're frightened of this. Because the Americans don't have that idealism, and they don't have that belief in a supernatural order of things which drives the Iranians forward.
Yeah, but they do have mastery of the skies, and it's kind of hard to feel mystical about bombs falling from the sky.
Well, yes.
Especially on a desert landscape that doesn't hide troops very well.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes,
you know,
parallels with Vietnam are not accurate.
No, mm-hmm. No, because they would be able to slaughter masses of people from the sky, and this is a scenario.
And the densely crowded Iranian cities.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I mean it would be horrendous.
Yes, it would be, but I don't think they really care about the loss of life. In fact, I think that actually would be a
genocide is part of the policy.
Okay.
I mean, like Manifest Destiny. I mean, I was just watching television tonight, and the White House representative was saying the trouble with the Iranians is that they do not keep their word. And I said to my wife, do you know, not one single treaty that the White House signed with the Red Indians in the 19th century was kept. Every one was broken. And by Washington, so the scenario is indeed bleak.
Yeah, it is. And you know, I mean,
if they could overthrow the might of the mighty Third Reich, what could they do to poor little Iran, let alone insignificant Syria?
Yeah, the vanguard against these people is people like you and I, and there is a groundswell in America.
You mean enlightened intelligentsia?
Well, it's beginning. It's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an awakening, and I've shared this with Colonel Barry Turner, and you know, we discussed for you know that I believe there's an awakening happening both in Britain and in America, just how devious and how criminal the leadership has been. And I think it might be a hard sell right now, and even though they have really no regard for the public opinion, I think it might be they'd be hard pressed to pull this one off.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm hoping.
Yep.
But
let's hope.
Well, you know, James, again, we've put in a good hour and 15 minutes of hard work here to help inform people about history, because you know these are things that are not shared in books. They're not discussed in the history of Western civilization. Or
they're never mentioned in the universities.
Never,
mm-hmm.
Never. And in fact, every person, every thinking person in the country should care about the things we shared, because there are parallels and there are direct connections to the present in all of these facts. And
mm-hmm.
So I want to thank you once again, James, for moving the ball even further down the field in the parlance of American football. You know, we ultimately, the goal is to get a touchdown, and the touchdown is going to be when we finally expose the Zionists for what they are, and that is a criminal cabal bent on world domination out of the Middle East. And that is a fact that everyone in this whole world needs to wrap themselves into and become aware of just how it's being done. And, of course, you've helped in your two broadcasts, and I want to thank you once again, sir.
Okay, rely on me anytime. Okay.
Thank you very
Good
much,
night.
James. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was James, Professor James Dickey, Scotsman, and I hope everybody out there can understand his pronunciation of certain things. There were some words that I didn't get clearly, but I want to thank you all again for tuning into the French Connection, and be back with us tomorrow for more important information.